Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Elizabeth Griffin appearing on behalf of Robert Herdman. Mr. Herdman, as you know, is serving 16 years to life plus 8 years for sexual assault and kidnapping in this case. I don't want to take anything for granted, so I want to start with Sergeant Gallegos, even though I think it's pretty clear. This is the last prosecution witness who the prosecutor asked about the fact that Sergeant Gallegos claimed Mr. Herdman had stayed in Kuwait and never went to Iraq. He said he was 99% sure and that the sergeant major had called 5 years earlier and told him that. And when the defense objected, the court summarily overruled it without any discussion.
So let's assume that it was hearsay evidence. It seems pretty clear that it was, actually. In the scheme of things, why isn't it harmless in this case?
Oh, gosh. It's not harmless because it blows a hole into everything because, as I explained in the reply brief, Mr. Herdman reported to the Fort Carson doctors that he had these nightmares and intrusive thoughts about seeing the bus explosion and Iraqi civilians, and this was causing his anxiety, in addition to having the field surgery on his appendix. And if you look at when the prosecutor was first questioning Dr. Pagliani early on in the case, I think she actually set this up because she asked Dr. Pagliani, and it wasn't clear why she was asking at the time, oh, well, is Kuwait part of the Iraqi theater? And Pagliani said, well, kind of. And then she's eliciting from Pagliani, well, what was Herdman saying was the reason for these nightmares and intrusive thoughts? Oh, Iraqi civilians dying. He saw lots of death in Iraq. So the prosecutor's actually setting this up ahead of time because obviously if Mr. Herdman was lying about that, which again, there's absolutely no evidence of that he wasn't in Iraq. This is completely unreliable.
In fact, wasn't there a whole bunch of, and let me apologize to both counsel, I had dental work this morning, so I'm still numb on one side. If I list for you don't understand me, just tell me. There was plenty of documentary evidence here that Mr. Herdman was in Iraq. I mean, it seemed to me, reading through some of the record here, that Sergeant Gallegos was kind of an outlier. I mean, and so I guess I'll pick up, you know, correct me if that's wrong, but it seemed like there was a document, and I do understand or remember that Sergeant Gallegos said, well, the document could be wrong. I think the defense lawyer kind of made him look like a fool, with all due respect.
Well, I wish you were right, and that would be nice, but I don't think that's correct, because Sergeant Gallegos tells the jury, that's not the final accurate document. You need other verification. That's not the document that shows where you were. And as I said, the prosecutor elicited from Pagliani early on, oh, is Kuwait part of the Iraqi theater? And so she's planting that seed that just because the discharge paper says Iraq, that might include Kuwait. I don't think it was at all made clear.
Did the prosecutor ever come back to this? Did the prosecutor argue that Mr. Herdman was not in Iraq, like in closing argument or anywhere?
The prosecutor implied in her closing, she said erroneously that the defense claimed that they gave you evidence that his unit was in Iraq, but they never gave you that evidence. Well, really, we weren't presenting that evidence because we didn't know of any reason that we needed to, but that was, she clearly was coming back to it when she said that, and we didn't need to prove we were in Iraq. That we thought that was already established and known. So yes, she's implying that he wasn't there. That this is just a huge bombshell, Judge. I mean, the importance of this in El Paso County, I can't even express how huge this is, that this guy is just a big fat liar, that he would lie about even being in Iraq means that he's a psychopath and you can't believe anything he says. All right, but I also made the cumulative error argument. And so if you don't think that by itself requires reversal, if you look at that in conjunction with all this evaluation evidence that came in violation of the Fifth Amendment, in violation of due process, in violation of the statute, and also all the specific objections that were made, irrelevance, prejudice, discovery violations, violations of court order, there's no question that a new trial is required in this case. And really, I think the only question should be, what comes in?
Can I back you up, Ms. Griffin, and perhaps you can help me? I want to make sure I understand the statutory scheme. And it seems to me like you're making a couple of arguments on this mental condition evidence, if we can call it that. It seems like you're making an argument, and correct me, that the statute was violated here, that the evidence came in violation of the statutes. You're also arguing a variety of evidence rules that also violate, and you're arguing that violates the privilege of self-incrimination. Am I right about that?
Absolutely.
Okay, can I ask you, I want to make sure I understand the statutory scheme. It seems to me that we're looking at 16.8.107, that under 1A, that would let in, I mean, they're all inadmissibility rules subject to exception. And so 1A, I want to talk about the exceptions. 1A, if I understand it, allows in evidence that goes to impaired mental condition to meet the defense claim of impaired mental condition. 1.5A has two exceptions in it. The first one deals with a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity, and the second one deals with the case where the defendant designates an expert on mental condition. First of all, am I right about that? Is that the statutory scheme?
Well, I think you're leaving out something that's crucial, which is that the defense has to be off introducing mental condition evidence for the purpose of showing incapacity to form a mens rea. And only then does that render some of this stuff admissible. Well, it's only admissible to rebut that and only for that purpose.
And I appreciate what you're saying. And so let me focus on that. Under 1.5A, the second half of it, I understand rebutting the mental or ability to form a culpable mental state under 1A. I see that. Under 1.5A, it says if the defendant undergoes an examination because the defendant gave notice under Section 3 he intends to introduce evidence, then the evidence of mental condition is admissible. And it seems like you're equating mental condition under 1.5A with this inability to form a culpable mental state.
Well, Herrera makes it pretty clear that the only reason this statute is constitutional, this whole scheme of making people go submit to examinations against their will, the only reason that's somehow not compelled self-incrimination, because obviously it is, but the reason they say it's not is because you can't use any of this stuff for guilt. And the reason you can't use it for guilt is the statute doesn't allow it. And then Herrera talks about the language where it only comes in for capacity to form mens rea. Now, I understand what you're saying. If you're saying the other part of the statute doesn't allow it, then it violates the Fifth Amendment.
But what about Bondurant? I mean, I understand what you're saying about Herrera. It does seem to be limited to that fact scenario. But as I read Herrera, it's talking about it comes in, essentially the prosecution gets to meet the defendant's evidence. And that doesn't violate the privilege as I read it. Now, do correct me if you think I have this wrong. Bondurant extended Herrera, I think, on the privilege issue beyond just an insanity kind of issue to more broadly mental condition. Bondurant, I think, had to do with a guy who was depressed, if I remember. So, I mean, I guess I have some concern that you're defining mental condition a little too narrowly. So convince me.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think our difference is not just mental condition, but that it can only come in for this capacity to form mens rea. And Bondurant, I agree with you. I think Bondurant's trying to push the limits a little bit. And I think it's wrong. I mean, I think once you start messing with the statute, you're violating the Fifth Amendment. I mean, that's what saves the statute. And Herrera's right on that. And I think it's questionable whether the statute's constitutional even with that limitation. But if you take away that limitation, and then look also at the due process problem here, because when the statute tells somebody that if you submit to this examination, we won't use it except to, you know, if you put in evidence that you don't have the capacity to form the mens rea, then we can do it. But then later after the evaluation, you say, well, that's not really what we meant. Really, we just meant anything having to do with mental condition or mental state. That violates due process. I mean, the laws have to be enforced. Promises are made. And if you don't like the Sandoval rubric or the Fisher rubric, even though I think it fits exactly because you're inducing self-incrimination with a promise, just look at due process generally. We tell you what the law means. And here, Mr. Herdman asked for further guidance. Tell me what the law means. so that I can advise my client exactly what's going to happen. And the courts just ignore that. They won't do it. They won't commit to anything. So, all right, what do I have? I have the language of the statute. The statute tells me it only comes in for capacity.
But why are you focusing on that? Because Wilburn and Flippo also say mental condition is broader than just going to forming a culpable mental state. Section 3 of 107 doesn't talk about forming a culpable mental state. It says if you all, the defendant designates an expert on mental condition, and it says mental condition, and it seems to me Flippo and Wilburn and Bondurant all say it's broader than what you're saying.
Yeah.
So I guess my question is what language are you focusing on to get the culpable mental state piece of this?
All right. I think there's two different things. And I know Flippo focused on what is mental condition evidence, and I'm not sure about all those cases and what they focused on, but there's one, the question of, is this mental condition evidence? And then there's two, was it introduced to show incapacity to form a mens rea? You see what I mean?
Yes.
So even if it's mental condition evidence, it's got to be introduced for that purpose. And if it's not introduced for that purpose, you don't get to rebut it, because that goes to guilt. And if you're not using it for guilt, if you're using it for involuntary intoxication, which is the specific affirmative defense that the legislature created, that the court can't repeal this statutory defense. That's why Garcia says this is the law. You know, if it falls under involuntary intoxication, that's the scheme that we go under. And you know what? The legislature's had 7 years since the Garcia case, and they could have repealed the involuntary intoxication statute or added something to that mental condition language and said, oh, this includes evidence of voluntary intoxication. But no, they didn't. Even though voluntary intoxication specifically goes to the impairment of mental capacity.
Pardon me, Ms. Griff. Why isn't this case just Wilburn?
Okay, I guess I need some more explanation about Wilburn.
Our Supreme Court told us in March of this year, in dealing with a condition that was not offered for the purpose of rebutting mental condition, that the combination of Section 107 3B and 106 3C basically requires that if you're going to put on any mental condition evidence, the defendant has to undergo an evaluation, and the results of that evaluation are admitted. Aren't we bound by what our Supreme Court has told us in Wilburn?
I guess I'm wondering if that was cited in the state's brief, and if not, I'd like an opportunity to brief on it.
Well, it was decided in March of this year.
Okay, I'd like an opportunity to brief on it, because I'm not aware of it, and I need to read it and see what it says. So may I? That's fine. Thank you. Listen, if you don't agree with the first claim, which is that none of this stuff should have come in, once the defense said, all right, listen, I won't ask my experts about mental condition evidence that shows incapacity to form the mens rea. If you don't agree about that, look at argument two. Because argument two, the stuff that came in, prediction of future violence, is never admissible, ever, in any case, okay? Take that together with the fact that he's got a psychopath's brain defect, which not only is that character evidence that's not admissible, it wasn't in discovery. I mean, we objected and said, Judge, we've never heard this before. Dr. Allen is testifying that he acted with goal-oriented instrumental aggression because he has this brain defect, and we said, we have never heard this before. Overruled. I need to save some time for rebuttal. Thank you.
So before I forget, what I'm going to do is give both sides 7 days to address the Wilburn decision. So you both have until a week from today. Yes. Simultaneous.
My name is John Seidel. Good morning. Bar number 1733, representing the people. I think the bigger issue is the sort of the mental condition evidence, but I know the council discussed the Gallegos testimony, so I think I'll start there and make a couple of brief points. If there are no questions after that, we'll move on. You know, the brief noted that Gallegos admitted he had no personal information about the defendant's location. He had no record of the hearsay statement from the commander. And what I think is quite significant is not only did Pagliani, the doctor who was treating him, testify about the DD-214, which is the actual form detailing his service, but, you know, she and Dr. Newman gave this guy serious medication. Two or three different kinds, Klonopin, Klonidine, Desiril, those kinds of things that border on, I mean, obviously they're psychoactive, but they're close to the kinds of medications that are actually used, like the antipsychotics, for serious medication. And Dr. Ballard, who was, if I recall, a doctor who treated the defendant on a private hospital when he was allowed to leave the base and go to a private hospital shortly before this incident. Dr. Ballard noted that he was receiving a large... Maybe he also testified that the person, the defendant, was on meds. And then one of the defense experts, it was not Guagarian, but it was the, I want to say, Detweiler. He testified that at the time of this incident, the defendant was receiving massive quantities of Klonopin, 6 milligrams a day, which is a large dose, way too much in that expert's opinion. And Pagliani and Newman also said repeatedly, we didn't think he was malingering. We had these really serious, significant anxiety problems, nightmares, trouble sleeping. And Pagliani even went so far as to say, you know, we not only did we believe that he was really suffering from these things, but she explained that he had seen a bus explode and body parts everywhere. So she was very sort of sympathetic to the defendant. In my mind, when two or three or more doctors are giving medications like this, it's clear that they believed what he was saying. And given that Gallegos had no information on it, really, other than what he heard, he was, I think, fairly biased. As this court just noted in response to opposing counsel, they demolished him. They made him look like an idiot. So even if there was a hearsay objection, which is makes it preserved, that's a harmless error. And, of course, the confrontation claim was never preserved, and so the same basic prejudice test applies, and there's no prejudice there, even if the error was
counsel,
obvious.
Mr. Sato, let me ask you this. So in addition to him to the very end of being combative about whether or not the defendant served in Iraq, what about the closing statement? Do you agree, in having read the record, that the prosecutor got up in closing and continued to plant a seed of doubt as to whether the defendant was in Iraq? Because that would be the people's representative at that point.
Well, I think, I don't remember the closing argument. So I don't distrust what she says about that. But it seems to me that what was being said there was, based on what defense counsel said, there was a comparison there between what the opening statement on the defense side was and what actually happened at trial. Now, that's fair, even if Gallegos' testimony shouldn't have come in, the prosecution can still make a comparison between what was said by the defense at the front and what happened at trial.
Well, is it fair if the prosecutor knows that he was in Iraq to suggest that there's a question as to whether he was in Iraq in closing argument?
Well, I think that if it's not their obligation to prove he was in Iraq, and the defense says they're going to do it, and they don't, and you've got, I mean, even there was a whole bunch of evidence that after the fact, you know, you had Pagliani and Newman who were treating this guy, and Ballard, on the one hand, saying didn't think he was malingering, and then on the other hand, you had the people that did the exams are saying, well, there is some evidence of malingering. So the fact that Gallegos gets up there and says maybe he wasn't in Iraq, and then the prosecution mentions that, I don't think that is by itself the prosecution's argument is relying on Gallegos. I think that they are pointing to the whole, that statement can be read as pointing to the whole fund of evidence that there may be a dispute about what it is that the defendant saw and how serious his condition was.
But it is very different, Mr. Seidel, about saying there's a dispute whether it's malingering or not. And as Ms. Griffin said, arguing to a Colorado Springs jury, home of the Air Force Academy, home of Fort Carson, where bodies come back all the time, to argue that this person is lying about being in Iraq is huge. And the prosecutor has an obligation. And I'll confess to you, I'm very troubled by that.
Well, first of all, nobody said he was lying about being in Iraq. It seems to me that, if I remember right, Gallegos said, I got a call from a commander that said this guy was leaving Kuwait for an appendectomy. Now, there's nothing, I don't remember that call, the content of that call saying, oh, by the way, I'm going to tell you right now, Mr. Gallegos, the sergeant, that this guy was never in Iraq, and I'm sending him home from Kuwait, and he never left here. All the guy said was, he's leaving Kuwait, and he's coming back because he has to have or had an emergency appendectomy. And then from then on, Gallegos was saying, if he left Kuwait, maybe he was never in Iraq. I don't remember the specific testimony that much, but I am saying that the defendant himself never said anything about it. And the dispute was he really suffering these effects? This post-traumatic stress disorder, and that's what's relevant here, not whether he was actually in Iraq. I mean, it's possible that he could have suffered PTSD or not just from having been in Kuwait. And it seems to me that the issue here, if we focus on the real issue, it's was he voluntarily or involuntarily intoxicated, and how did he get there? If either of those two things was satisfied, and it's a side issue as to whether or not he was actually in Iraq. And it was the defense who said, we'll show he was there, and in fact, they did. They said, here's his DD-214, and you have the military doctor saying that's what that means. And the fact that a low-level sergeant who happens to be biased disagrees, I don't think is enough to say, well, this is going to cause a reversal of the whole conviction, particularly when you know, the objection was hearsay, and it was nothing else besides that, not even a confrontation objection. So my argument would be, even if it is a Colorado Springs jury, it's not enough to cause a reversal of the conviction when you have vast amounts of evidence on both sides of the relevant question, which was his actual mental state.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Seidel. Is there anything in the record to suggest that a Colorado Springs jury is different than a Fort Morgan jury or a Pueblo jury?
Well, that's a good. I mean, no, there isn't. That question makes me wonder whether it's even appropriate to consider whether an error is more serious because it happened in Craig as opposed to La Junta. I'm not sure that that even goes into our jurisprudence because, actually, you know, after all, this court sits to decide cases of statewide, and its precedent, its cases have statewide, are valid statewide, published or unpublished, they are binding on the courts, all the courts of the state. So the short answer is there's nothing in the record, and I'm not even sure it's a legitimate consideration in the harmless slash plain error prejudice analysis.
Mr. Seidel, with your limited time, I want to shift gears. I would like to talk about the statute and the mental condition evidence. You heard me kind of present my view of the statutory scheme to Ms. Griffin. Do you agree with the way I presented it? And, of course, disagree if you do.
Well, I think I do agree, Your Honor. I guess to answer your question specifically, mental condition in 107, I think it's 1.53 or 1.3, A and B, is not statutorily defined. Now, after Garcia, which is the case the defense relies on, a couple of years after that, Filippo came out and said basically, mental condition unambiguously refers to any situation in, quote, in which insanity is not the reason the defendant seeks to introduce expert opinion, close quote. And then Wilburn came along and said that the learning disorder is of the type that qualifies under 107.3b. And then Bondurant, which cites Wilburn, says, you know, this person was claiming anxiety, depression, and multiple personality disorder, and the Bondurant panel said, a person of common intelligence would understand these to be mental condition. And I think that that was a basically a statutory interpretation, because the issue in Bondurant was the sort of the constitutionality of the statute, which in turn depends on its interpretation. So I do believe that mental condition is a very broad category.
And that's under 3B. And so 3B then, in your view, triggers 1.5, which says if the defendant designates an expert, then the prosecution gets to do an exam and puts on that evidence, correct?
Right.
All right. So in this case, it's a little bit of a wrinkle because all these experts did their reports long before the defense designated these three people. Designated the involuntary intoxication experts. And, I mean, how do you fit under any of these statutes?
Well, the defense position down below and here was always that Garcia said that you don't get an exam, it's not mandatory for an involuntary intoxication defense. And they went on to say, well, the past exams already done are no longer relevant. Okay, my answer to that is Garcia did not say and did not discuss whether a past exam, which was legitimately done pursuant to 107 and pursuant to the incompetency and the sanity statutes, could be admissible in a later proceeding where insanity and incompetency and stuff is not the issue, but some other kind of mental disorder is. Now, involuntary intoxication, so Garcia is really of no benefit here.
Well, how does that fit under the statute, though? How does it fit under the statute? Because as I understand it, 3B, when the defendant says, I'm calling an expert on this issue, then you get an exam, and then that whatever comes out of that exam is admissible. And here, I mean, what is the authority for saying you get to incorporate by reference what was done before? You have to, as I understood it, or at least there's some case law to suggest, you have to meet their evidence. That's how you get around the privilege against self-incrimination. And so how do you are meeting their evidence when you're incorporating something by reference from before, especially in this case, and I'm going to shut up in a second and let you address this, having this risk assessment in, and I'm going to tell you straight up, that is my biggest concern with your argument in this case. How do you put on a risk assessment guy to say, this person is a risk of two to commit a violent offense like this again? How does that meet evidence of involuntary intoxication, and how is that not prejudicial?
Well, I think the first part of the question is meeting the evidence. And the point I want to make is that when you raise involuntary intoxication, this is what the trial court said, you're saying that there was a drug given that caused a disturbance of mental or physical capacities, compulsory exams that were done prior to that, but concerning the same time period as the drug that's caused or drugs that are causing involuntary intoxication, are clearly going to address whether those drugs affected or caused a disturbance of mental or physical condition.
So you're saying they did meet the evidence.
And that's basically relevance. That's right. These guys did exams, and even Wurzel himself said, my exam, although it's couched in the terms of sanity, it's going to address and is perfectly readily applicable to determine voluntary or involuntary intoxication. And both all three of the experts, and this goes to your second question, Dr. Johnson. Dr. Johnson didn't say anything about what the defendant told him other than this guy, the defendant said, I've been doing drugs and drinking since I got back from Iraq. And actually, I think Johnson actually referred to Dr. Miller's report to give that evidence to the jury. Now, I don't think that Johnson was saying that this guy, the defendant, was at a risk. He's not saying that the defendant is personally, he said, I did a bond assessment. Now, I don't know why he was called, but I don't know that he was called to say that is what I mean to say. He was called to discuss the voluntary intoxication part of it, and also to say this guy showed signs of malingering.
But he specifically said he's, quote, a moderate risk of violence and a moderately high risk of repeating a violent offense.
What I'm getting at is that if you couple what he said with Dr. Allen, I think it was Allen, who said, look, involuntary intoxication is not probably the cause. This person had psychological or developmental disorders or problems coupled with, and I'm not even sure she talked about the defendant specifically about the amygdala thing, because I'm not sure there were any studies done on that. But she all she was trying to do is say, this person had some vulnerabilities that might make him, medically speaking, more prone, according to the studies, a little more prone to violence. Now, it seems to me that Johnson, all he did was look at the facts of this crime and say, oh, based on the facts of this crime, here's his score. That's not saying anything about his proclivities prior to this or even after this. He's just looking what the jury has already seen. Thank you.
I'm going to ask the bailiff to add a minute to Ms. Griffin's time to balance out the time.
Thank you. I just want to start with Sergeant Gallegos quickly and remind the court that the prosecution deliberately withheld this testimony. The prosecution investigator knew it. He didn't put it in the supplemental report. The court had specifically ordered all new statements to be turned over because of other violations of discovery. So this was a deliberate withholding surprise tactic. Other evidence insinuating that he wasn't in Iraq was from Dr. Johnson, who, after saying he fabricated the amnesia and PTSD, I think he said that, all three doctors said that, I think, insinuated that he must have fabricated his good employment record, his good Army treatment record, and insinuated that he even fabricated his combat experience. And he said that twice. And there was no grounds for that or reason, except maybe the DA had talked to him about this Gallegos thing. I don't know why else he'd be saying that. The mens rea, I didn't even get into, but Drs. Allen and Wurzel both testified directly from the evaluation that he knew what he was doing and that it was wrong, that his conduct was predatory, that he committed a predatory sexual act. That's intentional. That's not just knowing. That this was aggression to control someone. It was goal-oriented. It's like when you inflict harm deliberately out of hate.
Why isn't that responsive to the defense of involuntary intoxication?
Well, this is from the evaluation. I disagree, Judge, because you can't use evaluation evidence to talk about factual mens rea, ever. It can only be used for capacity. We didn't testify that he didn't have the mens rea, or even that he didn't have the capacity to have the mens rea. Our people testified about the impairment and the intoxication.
Counsel?
Thank you. I would ask you to reverse the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you both for your excellent arguments. I remind you both that you have 7 days from today to simultaneously address People versus Wilburn, which I believe is at 272 P3rd, 1078 at the Colorado Supreme Court, 2012. Okay, and a double space 5-page limit to those as well, all right? And with that, the case will stand submitted otherwise, and an opinion will issue in due course. That concludes.